All right, welcome back to another episode of the Magnus and Marcus podcast. I'm joined, as always, by John Marcus. John, how's it going?
I'm still here. I'm still breathing.
We're good.
Ready to give the people what they want. Watch out.
Good stuff. We have a special guest with us, Danny Mackey, the coach of the Berks Bees. Danny, nice of you to join us.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on here.
Sweet. So, in our brief discussion offline, we decided to talk about blending development in a high-performance culture. So I guess maybe to start, Danny, why don't you take us through a little bit of your background and how you came about coaching the Beasts and how that process worked?
Yeah, so I came about coaching the Beasts because I've always wanted to coach. And so I kind of stopped myself short. I always want to coach professionals, but I shouldn't say most people want to do that, but I wanted to do it. But I knew when I was 20, 21, that was a while ago when I was that age, but then there was maybe one pro group, you know, it was the farm team out in California and as Reebok Enclave at that time. So there wasn't many opportunities with it, but, part of the reason why I'm here is because I'm really stubborn and persistent. And so, it's like a lot of coaches, doing it for free was what was part of my job for 8 years. And then I got really lucky. I think our world is sadly like a lot of who you know. But like any other job, it's very much a timing thing. And so I'd worked at three other athletic apparel companies. I worked at Nike in their sports research lab for 3.5 years. I worked at Adidas in their athlete innovation department for a little bit. And I was a global product line manager for Puma in their running line in Boston. And all during that time, I was coaching on the side. I also coached when I was in grad school for exercise phys and biomechanics. So I do like the science side of it a lot, but that was going on during 2012. And in 2012, I'd been married to Katie for a little bit and I didn't want to coach her at all. I'm talking about Katie Mackey, and then was Katie Follett. And so I didn't want to coach my wife at all. And she had left her college coach and was with a post-collegiate coach for a while. Then we moved. And it didn't work out for her to be coached by him anymore, her post-collegiate coach. And so we're living in Boston. It's Olympic year. I'm coaching people at the time. I love coaching. And then she's just like, hey, well, we moved. You know what I'm doing. You love coaching. I've been wanting you to coach me. And I was like, okay, we don't really have another choice. And so I was coaching her and then two other post-collegiates at the time. And they were running well. And I had run for the shortest contract ever in Hanson's history. They still give me crap about that now, but from being in the industry for a while, I knew Brooks and I knew the head of sports marketing there, Jesse Williams. And so when Olympic year had ended, he'd been trying for like 5 or 6 years to start a post-collegiate group. And, when he did that, he basically just offered me a job. He's like, hey, you've been doing this. And, you know how you have to wear multiple hats from working in other companies. And part of this job at Brooks is going to be, it's going to be primarily coaching, but we want you to work also on these other things because we got to develop this culture at Brooks or help develop the culture at Brooks and at least appreciate like what pro athletes can do internally for an athletic apparel company. So that was my leg up to some degree. So I moved out in December of 2012 and then the team started January 1st of 2013. So this is going into my fourth year. I'm 39 months in right now. So
nice.
Yeah. And I've loved it. It's been really hard. I'm glad I worked in a corporate setting for a while and I'm glad I went to a really intense graduate program. And I'm glad I taught college for a couple of years because it's made me appreciate. Yeah. I was only thing I was adding was that I hope that even though it's really hard, I hope that I can do it as long as Gav's been doing it. That'd be awesome. So could do a podcast in 40 years.
Hey, you can't, because I'm going to retire in 5 years.
So I know. Your clock is ticking.
My clock's ticking. I'm out after the final or the Tokyo Olympiad. So
there you go. Setting
yeah. Well, but yeah, but you might be in media or something by then, Marcus. So you can.
That's true. That's true.
Do it. Yeah.
I'll be doing something different. You can count on that.
So I guess keeping going, you mentioned it was harder than you thought it would be. What do you think are some of the difficulties that you didn't expect that showed up at this level of coaching?
It's how persistent the job stress is. It is. The reason I was saying I'm glad I went to grad school, because it was similar where I was, you know, I was taking like whatever 12 graduate hours and teaching 5 classes, and it just never left. And so that's how this job is. I mean, it's my wife, even though she's a pro athlete, like she would get it more than anyone else, but she complains a lot with me just because I'm not really present. I'm not really around. And so the job will go as many hours as I'm awake. There's not like it's, I forget what day, the only reason I know what day of the week it is because we have usually like a habit with doing certain types of sessions on certain days, you know, like we lift on Tuesday and Friday and like, that's my marker. And I go to church on Sunday. If I didn't have those like placeholders, there's really not a difference between a Saturday and a Monday. And then it's the other hard part, like, yeah, it's just, it kind of will go all day. You know, I'm like, if I don't put boundaries up, there's something to do. Cause I'm dealing with humans. There's not really like a project and then we finished a project and it's done. There's downtime and there's not really vacation time. Cause they're being an endurance athlete is a 12-month-a-year job. It's not like an off season with other pro sports where they don't train for maybe a month. Or they don't necessarily have to be all in all the time. I mean, you get tested to your physical limits. That's that by nature, the part of track and field. And so if you're going to get tested that much, that means your psychology and physiology is going to get maxed out. And so that means that no stone's left unturned. And so there's a lot of things that get brought up and unearthed. I mean, usually yeah, you end up being like just spending a lot of time, like being a psychologist, physiologist, sometimes even a physio if need be, director of ops, travel agent. So it's just like all these things keep happening, and it's just that's part of it. I mean, maybe that changes if you get older and more. I get older, maybe more credentialed and more support there. But that was one part of it. The other part that's been surprisingly difficult is the politics. What drew me to track when I was really young, when I was 15, and I watched Michael Johnson win the gold medals and set the world record in 200 in Atlanta in 1986. I loved how black and white it is. And if like you guys know me a little bit or know me pretty well, but very like analytical and very objective about things. And so I like seeing like patterns and those things. And track was always interesting because you wouldn't really you just win the race. And that's why I like boxing and wrestling as well, because it's just, you just beat somebody, you know? And so it's even more simple to me than like MMA and boxing, because there is like, you don't throw like a haymaker and maybe catch somebody off guard and knock them out. In track, you just have to beat them or jump farther or jump higher. And so it's so simple, but it's so political. And so, I spend a lot of time like, I shouldn't say time. That just weighs on me emotionally. That's not like a time thing. It's just more of like it sometimes decreases the meaning and efficacy of the job to some degree. So those have been interesting growth areas over the past 3+ years. And it is a little different too. Like I was always, when I was coaching for free and volunteer coaching at a college, I was like, man, it'd be really awesome to do this for a living. But then once you start doing it for a living, it's like, man, if I mess up, what's going to happen to my mortgage in Seattle? Or, you know, I'm sitting there looking at like an athlete and I know that their contract's up in 8 months. And I'm like, I hope I do things right because I would hate to cost this athlete their career. And so that's a little different pressure. I like that more, but it's a little, I actually like that more than I thought, but it's also a little bit more stressful to some degree. Cause it's kind of when I have friends that all my friends have different jobs outside of, you know, people in the sport, I should say that's obvious, but the friends that don't work in the sport, they look at what I do and they're like, oh, that's really fun. Like you go to the track and you go to the weight room and you're kind of like a personal trainer. And gosh, I just sit in an office all day. And I'm like, yeah, it is. It's awesome. I'm like super grateful. And like I was just saying, I hope I do this as long as Gags has been doing it, but it's not like all fun and games. I mean, there's paychecks on the line. Tenth of a second can mean a career. There's a lot of pressure that comes along with it. So it's a little different that way.
Yeah.
I didn't get lined up. I was just telling the team today, we had a team meeting. And when I was working in footwear, even in a competitive, like when I was working at Nike, they didn't line me up against another footwear developer in 6 months. And they'd be like, okay, we'll see if you can make a better shoe. You know, it's not like that intense. And so, it's mano a mano. Everything matters.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I mean, I know it's something else when your performance is measured in black and white and you see how your athletes improve, and that's almost a direct reflection on how you're doing. What I'd like to understand, because maybe I struggle with this myself, is how do you keep yourself from driving yourself a bit mad trying to be too perfect when you don't need to be? If you know what I'm saying. I mean, when you think of,
yeah,
especially this year, right? When I've had athletes, it's Olympic year and it's like, make this team so they can get this contract. In the back of your head, you know, their entire future in this career is dependent on you getting them to achieve XYZ. Like, how do you prevent yourself from going too far in the wrong direction, I guess?
Yeah, I don't know how deep you guys go into this podcast, but the first thing that pops into mind is just the honest answer. I'm a Christian. And so that faith and spirituality helps, immensely. And I think you'd find that in any sort of high performance world. I mean, if we got to a deep, like philosophical discussion, I would start telling you why I believe in Jesus and those things. But the general scope of that mindset is that there are some benefits to, you know, jobs that require a lot of resilience, and that starts, you know, if I start there and it backs up, it helps with, if I'm thinking about an athlete who's trying to make the team and their contract's on the line and they're 28 years old, and I know that if they don't do it, they're old enough where they're kind of getting dropped, but they're, you know, top five in the US anyways, and they're better than me at their job in a relative scale. And this is, you know, I'm like, gosh, dang, I could beat myself up for days over it. I usually do what I tell them. I'm like, okay, well, there's a certain emotion that's coming from that I can choose to act on that anxiety or making that my idol, or I can take a step back from it. And I would say, well, why is this happening? Like, what's the meaning behind the emotion? And trying to become aware of that. And I tell my athletes to do that as they prepare for competitions or if they're in workouts. And so I just try to do that same thing. I mean, I take a step back and I think, okay, well, in reality is I know from science, even though I like to be objective, science just tells you that there's a lot of gray area, not black and white. So we got to live in that area. And also the more I know, it's funny thinking now at like 35, when I was in grad school at 25, like I remember one of my advisors in physiology, he was like, I think he'd published 130 papers by the time I was his student. And he was like, just super curious. And sometimes it's like, this dude just doesn't know. He's always like, well, I don't know. And I'm like, I know you know something, man. You published 130 papers. He's like, well, as long as I've been in this field, the more I learn, the more I start realizing I don't know. And he, you know, he's like, I always try to be curious. And he goes, things are actually a lot, as I become more knowledgeable, I start being able to simplify things. And so I take that approach as well. It's like, okay, well, yeah, I'd like to give myself a credit and be like, I'm this badass coach that if I do things right, I can kind of puppet master things along where, you know, Nick will run 142 and Kaz will be right next to him at 143 low and Katie and Garrett make the team. But the reality is I'm not that good of a coach. So, nobody is. And if I start thinking that way, then it becomes way more about me and it takes away from the meaning and becomes my idol. It's all I think about. And then, I also know that there's mistakes that might be made where I might fall ass backward into a good decision. And if I'm not super conscious of it all the time, it might prevent some like very good subconscious thoughts that are beneficial. So I try to like listen my grip a little bit. It's the same thing with an athlete. Use an egg analogy where they grip the egg too hard, they crack it. If they have too loose of a grip on an egg, they drop it on the ground. And so it's what's cool is not my job isn't that much different than theirs in that sense, where I have to be very like fluid in terms of like how much control I want to have, how much control I need to have, and how much does my job really matter. I mean, I was just talking to Marcus about this 2 weeks ago, and this comes from Dan Paff. He's like, John said, like, yeah, you put the ball out there and let him play. Dan Paff would say, when I'd ask him a million questions, I'd be like, well, what do you do this and this with, you know, Rutherford and Olympics? He goes, well, the good ones just figure it out. And, you know, Marcus said, well, you just put the ball out there and let them play. I mean, talent, cream will rise. And so that helps me like relieve a little bit of pressure. Like I look at somebody like Nick, even Katie sometimes, like they make you look like you know what you're doing. So, that part of it. And then other thing I just thought of it is like, you guys are laughing. Like I try to have fun with it. You know, if it's something like, if it is a job, it is a profession, and I'm talking about like my mortgage and all these other things that are these real life stresses, I still have a way easier job than most people. I still make a good living out of it. And it is really fun to work with people on a daily basis, that are highly motivated, that we get to travel a lot. And so I'm usually having a good time at practice. I mean, very rarely do I, even at meets too, when their stakes are high, like if someone were to come up to me, I'm pretty relaxed. So I try to have fun with it, a little bit of perspective.
Danny, in contrast that, you know, what you just were talking about with, you know, my analogy of rolling the ball in the court and letting him play. I mean, the Brooksby's makeup of the team roster now is, you know, kind of almost polar opposite than what it was that first year, that first 6 months when you were just trying to get blood. I mean, you go from, you know, having Katie as a centerpiece and then just kind of recruiting guys and girls who are in the area of Seattle and saying, hey, you want to come be a beast? And then, you know, starting off your recruiting efforts, trying to build the, you know, brand and awareness and caliber of the team, you know, with two guys qualifying in the 800 to make, you know, the Beijing world team last year. You know, kind of talk us through that, like, because some of those athletes you had in the beginning were really developmental athletes, and now you have some big name performers. I mean, Nick's a, you know, medalist. I mean, Kaz is on the cusp of being, you know, one of the next great young 800 meter runners for the U.S. I mean, you know, just kind of walk us through with how coaching those different athletes in the early years or early days of the Brooks Beast, and now, you know, the type of athlete you have now, you know, what are some lessons that you had about, you know, what you thought, oh man, this really works, this is really important, like doing these things are critical, versus now like, oh wow, really actually no, or things you thought that weren't that big a deal, now you know are like extremely important to get these athletes prepared for that high pressure stage, you know, in those big races.
Yeah, the big one that changed that was when we signed Nick, because we signed Nick 12 months in to the team, so he was the beginning of year two. And I remember having a conversation with Jesse Williams at Brooks in the fall, because Nick's contract was up. I said, it's like 90 days out or something, 60 days out, they can start talking. And he goes, what do you think about Nick Simmons? I was like, I don't know if I'm ready for that, man. Like, I just, the only guy I'm coaching right now works a part-time job. He's PR'd. He's run 145, but, you know, Nick just medaled and ran 142 last year. So, it was something, but I also told him, I was like, but I'm a sink or swim type person. So like, let's do it. I'll figure it out. And so I remember that it didn't hit me until actually last year with him, where I was like, man, this is a big contrast was the mental side of it. And the sports psychology part of it. And so that's why this year, like, I started working with this guy named Dr. Jim Bauman. He's in Seattle. And so he's got, I think, 35 years of experience. He's got more gold. He's worked with more medalists than I have with athletes. And so the reason why I started working with him, I was like, I need to get a lot better at this area. I need to make sure my athletes are calm. They're aware. We've done strategic talking. We're building, we're periodizing our mental preparation leading into big championship races, as well as a physical. I mean, Nick is, in some ways, his workouts are, I mean, Steve would know this because we trade workouts, but they're pretty simple. I mean, what Nick does is like really simple. I mean, Nick posted his training log with Roland, but the mental side of Nick is a whole nother ball game, really complex. And it, that just caught me off guard. I just assume that guys that are in Olympic final are just like Navy SEALs, you know, they just kind of have it or don't. But then I just felt really dumb after getting high performance athletes like Nick, where I was like, wow, this is definitely a trained skill. And then I start finding out that, oh, Navy SEALs actually spend a lot of time. They spend, I don't know what it is, something like $3 million per high, like a high level special forces in the military is what the government spends on them to get them prepared. And so it's not just something that you just have or you don't have. It's just like a technical part of running that you need to work on. So that was the thing that really threw me off guard. Another difference between the development and like a high performance, if I look at someone like Katie, who, I mean, she never really was development, but you know, this is a big difference between running 4:10 and 15:40 to 15 flat and 4:03 and, you know, winning a diamond league. Like, she's now at a point now where if she doesn't make the team this year, it's a disappointment. Whereas like before, when I first started working with her, she was making finals at USA's. So the things that have not been important maybe are something specifically like volume, you know, like how our discussions about volume become less very like are sometimes important, but like as the season moves on, we don't really talk about it before. Whereas initially, like, that was something we really discussed a lot, was like making sure we had X amount of miles a week. And now it's looser on that end, but it's very intentional on the days, you know? So today, for example, she had, I think, a 67 minute run on the schedule. It's recovery day. And we're out running on the trails, or they were, and she goes, hey, I'm a little tired. I'm at 40. And I'm like, okay, just do 40. And then if you feel good later, double later. If not, just call it a day. And 4 years ago, we would have been like, oh man, Katie felt tired. She'd do 70 minutes. Now she does 5-6 miles. And I'm like, well, today's a recovery day. She's like, yep. So her overall week might look, there might be some variance on that volume at the end of the week, but the patterning of the intention is really specific. And so I give and take a little bit on both sides of that. And injury prevention's probably has gone up a little bit. We've always had a really good medical team from the gun. We've been really fortunate actually in Seattle, because we have In Health and Real Rehab that have been amazing from day one. But we've added on more people like John Pierce, and a physiologist and nutritionist, Kyle and Corey, that like kind of help fine tune things. So I outsource a little bit more than I did before, because there's a difference between 145 and 143. And the difference is maybe training gaps. They really can't happen at all. So I have to keep someone like Kaz healthy all year. Again, it's like that same discussion with Katie, like being really intentional on days. But, you know, he just, like Kaz, for example, indoors had a vitamin D issue with supplements. And if he's maybe like not training at a super high level, not the development athletes are not, but some of there's just that slight less degree of training that they're doing because they probably have another job, which is the athletes I were first working with had other jobs. Whereas Kaz's full-time job is a train. So he's pushing himself a little bit more. And having that free time lets things slip through the crack. You know, he runs out of his multivitamin, ends up being El Nino year. So it's rainy as crap in Seattle. He doesn't see the sun for 4 months, starts running like crap. And all of a sudden, you know, we're like, dude, have you been taking your vitamins? You know, because that's really all our supplement plan is a multivitamin, some fish oil, and just timing of stuff. But, you know, he just missed that. He missed that. And I didn't have those discussions with developmental athletes, because, like I said, I'm trying to get him into the finals versus to get him on teams. Not that any is less important, but when mistakes go higher, you start paying attention to little things like that a little bit more, because the impact is really big. So a struggle I've had though is streamlining the job roles, you know. And so the one thing that is the same as athletes go from maybe like my first year when I had four athletes and or five, I should say, and two of them were maybe developmental that had other jobs, to now where I have 17 and all 17 of them professional runners, is I still am like the gatekeeper kind of bodyguard for them. You know, I have to make sure that they're talking to the right people, that they're not getting overwhelmed, that it is really simple. And so that's something that I've kind of learned this year, like right away, is like, I can't outsource too much. Cause it is on me at the end of the day. Like, I'm kind of responsible. That's why I said bodyguard. Like, I was kind of joking around with them. I was like, you could think of me as like your 150-pound bodyguard. Like, I got to make sure that you're talking to the right people all the time, and I'm protective over you guys. And like, I'm the one that's really picky and nitpicky and objective about everything. And so that's how I was with developmental, because I had less, but, yeah, I'm not as trusting, I guess, even as I've gotten a little bit older with the team.
I like that. I mean, I don't know, Steve, you can chime in. For me, a lot of it's very similar here. It's a constant give and take. You have to know when and how to, you have to know when and how to, kind of keep them on task and keep them on point, but then also at the same time too of how to give a little bit of a leash so they have that autonomy, they have that like buy-in that they have a little bit of control. So I think a lot of people think coaching distance runners and coaching, you know, development or high achieving distance runners or high performance distance runners is all about X's and O's and this and that. But, you know, as you found, Danny, and we've talked about this offline many times, it's more about just relationship building and understanding on, you know, what wavelength each person's on. And I think that's the hardest thing for, say, non-high performance coaches or non-adult coaches listening. If you're coaching, whether it's high school athletes or college athletes, you know, it's how you build that relationship. And as you get more proficient, the little things matter a lot more. But in the early stages, it's like the big things matter the most. So if you're coaching people who are new to the sport or young or just not that good, you just need to do the big things like run miles, stay healthy, you know, run tempo runs, speed work, da 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 da. That's going to keep them from getting real good. Now, with someone like a Kaz or a Nick, you assume, or Katie, all that stuff's on point. And so these little variances are like, hey, what's your ferritin level at, you know, 49 versus 100? I mean, that makes a big impact. Like, if your hemoglobin's here or there, that has a huge impact on how they feel day to day, because you guys are pushing so hard at a high level. And, but I find that too a lot. Like, it's a constant compromise, right? It's like, hey, with Tara Welling, it's, you know, okay, hey, here's the idea, here's the plan, how do you feel? And I mean, I'm glad you said that about Katie, because we'll do the exact same thing. I mean, even like today, we had 200 meter strides planned for her. And she was like, I just don't feel so poppy. Like, can I do 100? Like, yeah, do 100 meter strides. Like, it's fine. That's fine. Like, you know, the plan is just basically a foundation, a springboard off of, and give us a structure, cohesion, and guidance of where we want you to go fitness wise. But we have to be on point and on time in the day to day moments to make sure we don't do anything. I always tell people, it's better to abbreviate a session than to complete a session, but have the impact of completing that session, you know, be so severe that you now have to take 3 or 4 days or a week off, versus if you abbreviate a session and you feel and you bounce back quickly, or you feel good and it's maybe 1 day off or 0 days off because you were really aware in the moment that you weren't feeling awesome, that much more long-term has a high positive impact versus just completing the thing that was on the piece of paper that day.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, one of the things you touched on earlier and said is that coaching is about dealing with people. And I think sometimes as coaches, like if you look at our learning pathway, it's always through either the science or physiology or the workouts, and we're taught to obsess over the training dynamics of it, whether that's miles per week or whatever it is. and we're not ever taught, there's no classes given on dealing with relationships and people. And I think that that causes us to neglect that until we finally come around and realize, I think we've all had those moments where we realize it's a people business and it's about dealing with these relationships. You know, I think one of the moments or one of the things that kind of cemented that with me and listening to you, Danny, talk is thinking back to that email exchange we had where you asked about my word choice on telling an athlete to do this versus asking them to do that. And I think in that exchange for you guys, as we were talking about sending athletes training and whether we tell them to do ABC or we ask them to do ABC on the workout. And I think those are the considerations that you take once you've gone through coaching a while, or at least experienced a bit, that you don't even think about in the early days. Because in the early days, it's just, I'm going to dictate this workout program and they're going to do it. Or I'm going to show up to the track. Here's the workout. We're going to get it done. And as you develop as a coach, you realize that it's more about this relationship and realizing that athletes have to have some degree of intention and control. And it's this back and forth between control and autonomy that you have to give. And those are to me, the real art style of coaching that makes the difference, that we don't ever learn in the classroom. So.
No, yeah, we don't learn. I learned it. Well, I got exposed to it. I shouldn't say I learned it. I got exposed to it because I was a teacher for a while. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the managing people part of it is super important. I could have the best program in the world, but if they don't, if I don't have that relationship with them, when I say relationship, it's a trust based relationship. It's positive. And like in terms of like, it's optimistic. There's equal skin in the game on both sides. If I don't have that with them, it doesn't really matter what the workout is. I mean, that was year one with Nick, was just like getting to a point where we could work well with each other. Cause as the stakes go higher from a developmental athlete to a world-class athlete, if those foundations aren't in place in the relationship, it's hard to get the job done. And it's very unlike any other job. Like, I didn't deal with this when I was working at Nike or Adidas in the corporate setting, because I saw my boss 8 hours a day, which is a lot, but I didn't see him. I wasn't living with them at altitude camp. I wasn't, with them 7 days a week, in Seattle and traveling to meets and watching them throw everything out on the line. And so that's Phoebe, right? You guys have had Phoebe on there. She's one of the athletes I work with. And so she jokes around with me. She goes, yeah, I think you could be a crappy, you could have the horrible programming. You could make us run hard every day, but as long as we knew that you cared about us, I think we'd probably run decent. So she got a point. Like, my college coach was he's a phenomenal coach, but if I look back at the workload that he put us through, I'm like, man, that's crazy. Like, how did we run so well? I mean, it made sense. He periodized. He's a really smart guy. We ran well for a reason from the X's and O's standpoint, but that guy loved us. And so we would run through a wall for him. And I'm reading John McDonald's book right now. That dude is, a maniac with what the program he gave those guys. But he had the chapter I'm on with him is he's talking about the relationships and getting to know the person, making sure that they know, what makes them tick, but it's not a manipulate. It's not like to be manipulative with them. It's so that you really can understand them and you start seeing it show up with like body language and, well, what does Katie mean when she says I'm tired versus Kaz, or Nick? And it's two very different things. Like, if Kaz is tired, I don't push him at all. If Katie's tired, I ask her a couple questions, because sometimes she just like has other things going on and she's not separating it from work enough. And, those are things that I wouldn't know unless I was investing in them off the track.
Yeah. I mean, I think I think that's a very good point. I mean, I know on my college team, for example, it's relationships matter so much. And if they feel like they're invested in, then they're going to run well almost no matter what. I mean, I've had guys who have run 1 to 2 days a week and run well, because I think it's mostly because it was the first time they had someone who actually, you know, gave a shit how they ran. So, it matters a ton. I mean, I guess going back to a little bit on where you talked about the Navy SEALs and building relationships in that way and figure out what someone ticks, what do you think are some ways to build resilience now, or psychological resilience, now that you've discovered with maybe high level athletes?
I need a lot. I have a lot to learn in this area. And so this is a, you know, I've been talking to Dan Pfaff about this, and then Dr. Jim Bauman, who is a sports psychologist, and they've, so it's an ongoing discussion. So if we talk in a year, it'll be, you know, hopefully with some more information. But right now, I'm mostly focusing on being solution oriented with them. Mm-hmm. And so even on the track, if something's not, or if it's windy, like it is, was today, like, okay, well, what's the plan B option? And when I go through, I did it this year when I was talking race strategies for indoors, because we weren't that in shape, but the athletes that competed well. We had five people in five races, and the five races where we had somebody like at least up in the front trying to win it. And so one of the things we did was, like, I was like, okay, well, if this person does this, what are you going to do? If this person does this, what are you going to do? Versus before, I was, okay, like, be at this split at 200 and 400, or just make sure you're on the outside of the leader's shoulder. But this year I did way more, I got this word from Terrence Mahon, is game theory. And so it was just like, what do we do when this happens and this happens and this happens? So what I'm essentially training them to do is to be solution oriented, which is a part of resilience. So it's like, you look at, like, where are they able to have a positive outcome when they're in a high stress situation? And so do it a lot with race strategy. When they're in workouts, and I know you do this, Steve, where you kind of set them up not to fail, but you know that it's going to be hard. And when that happens, I don't provide the solution for them there. I just ask questions. And then if they get through it well and they execute as well as possible, and right afterwards we debrief, and I'm like, okay, what did you do there? Like, how'd you get through that workout? Or if I can see them struggling and they figure it out within a session, like, what did you do? And so I'm just trying to increase those, like, that mapping, and like, okay, this is what I've done. I've done this 10, 20 times. And if it's something big where it's like an ongoing chronic issue, and I said this a couple minutes ago, where I try to get, like, behind the emotion a little bit and make them a little bit, try to make them aware of where it's coming from. So that's just a lot of discussions in one-on-one meetings. And it boils down again to being solution oriented with it. But, yeah, we spend a lot of time talking about those in our one-on-ones versus, like, are we going to do aerobic tempos or true tempos? I mean, those are always part of what we do, but my one-on-one meetings spend a lot more time with those aspects. Like, okay, you felt this way. How did you act when you felt this way? Why'd you feel that way? What are you going to do when you feel that way again? And when they're exposed to it, in a race or leading up to a race, they're prepared because they've had to deal with it a couple of times in workouts or the days leading up to workouts. And so they know the solution, or they at least have hope that, oh crap, I've never seen this, but I've always been solution oriented every day for 100 days in the U.S. championship. So I'm going to figure it out. You know, they don't panic necessarily. You got to controlling that impulse is really important.
Yeah, that's a great point, Danny. I think, you know, you and I, and I think we've all had this conversation either one-on-one with each other or, you know, collectively or with other people. It comes down to intelligence, not fitness, at the level, you know, we're preparing some of these professional athletes at. And I think even that holds true for any level. When you get to a championship environment, it's, you have to take, you know, with a certain grain of salt, that everyone's kind of equally fit in that final, because they had to run a qualifying mark to get there. They had to go through a round, you know, I mean, so what's the big differential then if everyone's equally fit, plus or minus, you know, a couple percentage? It's then how people respond and react in the moment, how stressed with bad stress they are, how motivated and focused they are. You know, I mean, you know, talk, I think this one's one that I think a lot of people find interesting is actually talk about Katie last year. She goes from falling in the final at the US trials in the 5K to then winning a Diamond League. Like, you know, that's a really critical moment, you know, coaching moment and teachable moment. And I'm just curious, how do you, especially with it being your wife, you know, too, and wearing that hat or taking that hat off, you know, how are you able to get her in a space where that didn't emotionally wreck the rest of her outdoor season? Or because, you know, it really could. It could have. I mean, it was a total bomb. And I remember standing with you when it happened, and you were a little deflated in the moment.
Oh, I'm sure. Little you deflated. Know? I'm pretty sure that there's like a – I won't name her name, but there's no way this athlete will ever join the Beast because she was sitting one row back from me when Garrett got fourth, and then Katie tripped like 30 minutes later. Yeah. And she – there's. I was like, yeah. To be deflated, say it was deflated as an under.
I was embarrassingly mad. Yeah. Well, it was a funny juxtaposition overall because, yeah, Katie and Garrett just, you know, had those calamities happen to them. And then, like, was it the same day or might have been the next day? Then Kaz and Nick,
no, it was
like,
the same day.
Yeah, it was the same day. Then you, like, went from, like, oh my God, this is, like, the worst day for Brooks Beast ever. I'm the worst coach in the world to, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing ever. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's the ups and downs of a track meet because you have skin in the game. But I'm really curious, like, how you pulled it all back together for yourself and also Katie and got her to have like a hell of an outdoor season and outdoor campaign in Europe.
Yeah. This would be the one where like I kind of fell backwards into it. Cause I didn't know, I'd never seen that happen before, you know? So what I did was at first I just listened to her. she just got it all out there and she was really pissed at me. She still is mad at me for doing it. But when she calmed down, There's an element, I think, all of it where I have to be looking like down the road. I mean, that's as a coach, if I'm having perspective, I'm the one that got to look that has looked 12 months down the road. And I told her, I said, if you do what you did in this race again, you won't be an Olympian. And that she was not happy that I said that. But the reason why I said that is because, yeah, she tripped. That wasn't her. There was really... she could have maybe done something. I mean, Tully was doing what Tully should have done. She stepped out to get going. Katie, I think, could have a little bit more space knowing that you're about 800 meters to go and people are going to be making moves. Like she was just maybe not giving enough space there, but you could also argue like Katie could just push Tully off the track because she was impeding her a little bit. So that's racing, not really anybody's fault. But where Katie made the mistake was when she got back going again, she caught up to them, and then when the bell lap went, she swung out to lane three and just passed them and took the lead. So in 400 meters, she goes from nearly tripping and falling, losing 3-4 seconds, catching back up to them in 300 meters, and then blowing by them around the curve. And I'm not sure, but I know that wasn't smart, but I'm not sure if that cost her a spot in the team, but I know that wasn't smart. And I'd seen her do that in 2013 at USA's in the 1500 where she got knocked around a little bit, and she swung out to lane four in the 1500 and just tried to win it. And I think her last, what won the 15 in Des Moines in 2013 was like a 59.1 last quarter. And the race was like one around 420. And then at Falmouth, like 7 weeks later, Katie ran a 58.2 last quarter in a race that was similarly paced and she won it. So I know she had the speed to do something. That was the most fit I've ever seen her was, oh no, 2014 was the most fit I've seen her. But, you know, so I've seen her do that twice in a row at US Championships. And like I was just saying a minute ago about impulse control. And so I didn't want to say it, but I had to tell her that. And I was like, you're going to feel like this every time if you're not willing to work on this part of your impulse. Like you got to be able to control that. Like Katie be better off as an MMA fighter than a runner because she's so aggressive and like just takes things really personal. And that's why she can win a Diamond League is, you know, she wins. She's one of the few pros that wins about 3 to 5 races every year. She wins because if she's near the front and she smells blood, there's something that just comes out that's just how she is. And so you know, she gets knocked around and it's like someone throwing a jab and hitting her in the nose. And she just is like, well, yeah, I'm going to take you head on. And they're like, well, that's not, you're not going to beat somebody up like that because it doesn't work. You got to be smart. So I said that to her, not a good idea, but I think it'll be helpful for this year. And after that, you know, I gave her space. I think that was like probably a thing I did well. I just let her just do her thing. And she acted as if she had made the team in terms of like, we went to Nick's run gun party that night and we did like a 1 day vacation hike thing. I shouldn't say it was vacation. We took 1 day totally away from the sport and we're in the mountains. This where like as a husband, that was kind of a good thing. If she was, you know, if I was another athlete, I would tell them like, do something you want to do for a couple days. And then we met Wednesday. We talked about it and I said, well, here's why we're going to look at it. Like this happened and it can't be any worse of a way to lose. But if we look down the road in September, we know you're in one diamond league right now. We know you're really fit. We know you can, you know, maybe break four. If we get into five, you can get after 15. We have these big goals. You have to like forget about what happened and just get excited about what's in front of you because these opportunities are here and these are really important. And I coach them all year. We're a championship focused team, but I really only bring up the championships like three or four times specifically because I do think there's other importance to these other races. And so they're not like fatalistic mentality in general on this team because going into stuff like that, I don't think it's good to be like, this is game seven with 30 seconds left to go going into Eugene. I'm like, this is the most important race of the year. We call it what it is, but this is not going to define you as a person. If you have perspective and you have a sense of meaning, this isn't going to kill you. And so, yeah, she got into a diamond league. And so we made the focus. We shifted it really quickly, like that Wednesday. And I got excited about like, let's try to break four. And, you know, she did well enough in Hoisin. It wasn't anything crazy. She was like, I think 403, 404, just off the win. Then London was a diamond league. And, we found out like right around there that she got in Stockholm and Katie, because she is so emotional, she's like, she gets excited about big meets. And so once she got in that, like I was kind of like, I don't know, like a first year coach. I was like, this is awesome. Like, let's do this. You're going to race on live TV. There's prize money on the line. You're racing some of the best athletes in the world. Like, this is what is fun about your job. And like, this is genuine. Like, how can you not get excited about London and Stockholm? And so, yeah, she was just in a really good, relaxed spot. And, yeah, that's how it worked. And she did the rest. I mean, I wasn't actually even there for Stockholm, which is frustrating. I was there for every other race, but I had to go back home for work, other work stuff. And I missed that race, but, that's what's funny too. People think I don't see Katie probably 6 weeks a year, even though she's like my athlete and I'm, or an athlete I work with and then we're married, but yeah, I missed that race. But, yeah, that was kind of how that process worked. So,
I mean, that's awesome, Danny. I think there's a lot of good, you know, things people can derive from that. I mean, the main thing is just, you know, like what I really like is like all the questions you're asking, making the athlete think critical, you know, of themselves, and two, not hovering and belaboring on, you know, and crying over spilt milk, because that's kind of what it is. I think sometimes with young athletes, even if they're competitive, the transition between collegiate track racing and professional or even, you know, national class track racing is it's a lot more physical than it was before. And I think it catches people off guard and even still seems to catch pros off guard to this day. It's not just necessarily in a 15 or a 5 or a steeplechase or even a 10, you know, this walk in the park. It's like there's shoving, there's elbows. I mean, we saw, I think, in every race, right, at USA's outdoors last year, like one key person fall. Katie fell in the, you know, 5K. Someone fell in the women's 15, I forget who, and then, you know, Maggie Vessi fell in that women's 8, right? And people underestimate how physical it is. I wonder, you know, now that you have a big cohort of professional athletes, do you guys do anything, like, in practice to kind of mimic the physicality that they're going to be exposed to? Or do you just talk about it and hope people are on their game? I mean, you know, one thing I try to experiment with is just having people get in there and get uncomfortable. And even me being in there running alongside them, just kind of like not letting them move or throwing a bow and being like, hey, how are you going to deal with this?
Yeah, I didn't do it last year. This year I did because of you and I are actually the ones talking about it. This year I do those same things. I'll have a teammate like kind of shove another person. I'll put stuff in lane one. I'll walk around in lane one. You know, I'll like do things like not call it split. It's call it the wrong split. I don't do it a lot because it doesn't happen all the time. I don't want them like anxious going into workouts, but, yeah, we are doing those things this year because I think that you got to look at the data and just say like, well, that's a part of racing. Got to be prepared for it. And we talk about it still too, but, we do those types of things in practice and let them see it. I'm really big on just like that visualization. So it could be something simple, just me standing in lane one and having them have to run around me. Stupid. Looks stupid. But and they kind of laugh at me. But if they've done it before at race pace, and if somebody goes down and they got to jump over them or move, then they at least done it before. I've even had like, you know, if Katie and Hannah are running a 1500 workout together. We haven't done much of those, but the one or two that we've done is, you know, I'll make it where Katie has run on the outside of Hannah all the way through the curve, you know, all the way around the curve. And just be, you got to just be running on lane one or lane two, sorry. Or have it where they box Hannah in. She's got to run that rail and be comfortable with it. So little stuff like that we do. Like I said, it'll be interesting to see if how much they like it. The first workout, they're all kind of mad at me. But I think the last one that we've done, we've only done two of those. They seem to kind of enjoy it a little bit more. And the guys are funny. They didn't even care at all that I was doing that. The women are kind of pissed at me, but the guys are like, whatever, this is Danny's board, so he's throwing shit in lane one.
Well, I always remind the athlete.
But what's interesting is like the guys don't fall as much either. That you mentioned women.
Yeah.
So Maggie fell, Katie fell, Gabe fell.
Yeah, Gabe fell, that was it.
In the guys' race, no one fell in the men's 8. No one fell in the men's 15. I didn't see anybody tripping the men's 5. So there is a little bit of a difference gender wise between the contact and falling and, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't know what it is, but I've noticed that in the practices as well. They guys don't seem to care at all. I could throw like hurdles for 3 lanes and they would get more irritated that I threw them off for splits versus anything else. So
yeah, I've noticed the exact same thing. Like anytime I do stuff like that, whether it's college or post collegiate, the guys just kind of take it, and the women can have a different reaction to it. So even something as simple as taking away watches and manipulating splits, my women aren't very happy at me when I do that, but it's a part of the game. But I think that all comes back to like the earlier point you made, which is like having creating solutions oriented people and like giving them the opportunity to experience things that they might have to deal with in a race. I mean, to me, it's all about dealing with and coming up with models for them to respond to different behaviors. So it might seem ridiculous, but taking someone who's used to leading and sticking them somewhere else in the pack, like gives them experience to it. So they don't have that freak out, moment that you kind of mentioned. So,
right.
I think that's all right on, but we're going on about an hour now. So, we don't want to keep you too long, Danny, but, appreciate all the wisdom you've dropped. And, it's definitely been enlightening to me, even though we've talked a bunch. So, appreciate it and hope everyone gets something out of it. John, you got any wrapping statements?
I think, you know, if you've heard any continuity between what Steve and I talk about and what Danny's been talking about, it's a lot more process oriented as you evolve your craft. You know, I can think the same thing like Danny and I, or, you know, when I started off as a younger coach, it was much more X's and O's, get people physiologically, you know, you know, it wasn't more the psychology, it was more the physiology of it. It was like, let's get them fit and everything will take care of itself. And now it's like, you know, let's get them smart, you know, really solution oriented, you know, think on their feet, and also get them loyal and excited and know that I care about you, like, to the end of the earth. And then it will be easier to get fit. And so I think once I had that revelation, I flipped the paradigm that I was operating on, you know, what was the first priority. That's when I saw athletes really be able to do some exciting things for them that they never were capable of doing. And it warms my heart to hear, you know, Danny express a similar sentiment. So, you know, I always come the yin to Steve Science Yang. So, you know, be about the psychology necessarily before you're, you know, and don't have it be at a cost to, or don't have the physiology be at a cost to the psychology of it, because I think they're both balanced and they both need a certain degree to have success with any athlete at any level, regardless if you're preparing high school athletes for a JV final or whether you're trying to prepare people to make Olympic teams.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the cool thing, is that so many of the things Danny brought up are same lessons we've been harping at, and it's that progression as a coach from a younger coach who focuses on maybe the details of the workout so much and loses sight of everything else. And if anything, it's about stepping back and seeing the bigger picture and dealing with people and realizing what matters and what doesn't matter. So, cool deal. Well, that was fun. We'll bring another one to you guys soon. Thanks for listening.